Matthew 12, our topic for this workshop session is entitled The Basis of the Second Coming of Christ. And we're going to be dealing with a specific condition that must be met, which before Christ can return for the purpose of setting up his messianic kingdom. And we'll be dealing with quite a bit of our time with segments of the life of Jesus. But as we go through those segments, you'll see that we're going to be dealing with a Jewish frame of reference. And much of what Jesus does and say fits within the framework of first century Judaism and first century Jewish thinking, though much of this has been lost on the church in subsequent centuries. But from it, we'll be able to see what the basis of the second coming is. Now, before we can actually begin to answer the question of what is the basis of the second coming, we need to raise another question first and seek to answer it. And the first question is, what exactly happened at the time of the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus? Once we clearly understand the issues involved in the rejection of his Messiahship, we will, in light of that, be able to understand the precondition of his return. And so to answer the first question first, we turn to Matthew 12. Now, between chapters 4 and 12 of this gospel, Jesus has been going all over the land of Israel, proclaiming himself to be the Messiah and authenticating his claims with miracles, signs, and wonders. Now, the purpose of the miracles of Jesus between chapter 4 and 12 have been for the purpose of serving as signs to Israel to get Israel to make a decision concerning his messiahship. These miracles were intended to authenticate both his person and his message. His person, that is the Jewish Messiah, and his message, that he is offering to Israel the kingdom of the Jewish prophets. So that if they want to accept him as the Messiah, they can see the Messianic kingdom established right there in their day. So keep in mind the purpose of his miracles up until the point of what we're about to read have been for the purpose of serving as signs to Israel to get Israel to make a decision concerning his messiahship. And so we pick up our reading with verse 22 of Matthew 12. There was brought unto him one possessed with a demon, blind and dumb, and he healed them inasmuch the dumb man spake and saw. And all the multitudes were amazed and said, Can this be the son of David? When the Pharisees heard it, they said, This man does not cast out demons, but by Beelzebub, the prince of demons. And knowing their thoughts, he said unto them, Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation. Every city and house divided against itself will not stand. And if Satan cast out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? For if I by Beelzebub cast out demons, for whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore shall they be your judges. But if I by the Spirit of God cast out demons, then is the kingdom of God come upon you. For how can one enter the house of the strong man and spoil his goods, except he first bind the strong man, and then he will spoil his house? He that is not with me is against me, that gathers not with me scatters. Therefore I say unto you, every sin and blasphemy shall be forgiven unto men, but the blasphemy against the Spirit shall not be forgiven. And whosoever shall speak a word against the Son of Man, it shall be forgiven him. Whosoever shall speak against the Holy Spirit, it shall not be forgiven him, neither in this age nor in that which is to come. In verse 22, the incident began when Jesus cast out a demon that caused the person to be both blind and dumb, meaning he was a mute so that he could not speak. Now, the act of casting out demons by itself was not all that unusual in the Jewish world of this day and age. Even the rabbis and the Pharisees and their followers had the ability to cast out demons. Jesus even says so in verse 27 with his own challenging question, By whom do your sons cast them out? However, in Pharisaic Judaism, in order to be able to cast out a demon, one had to use a specific ritual, and this ritual had three distinct steps in it. First of all, the exorcist would have to establish communication with the demon. When a demon speaks, he uses the vocal cords of the person he controls. Secondly, after he established communication with the demon, he would then have to find out the demon's name. Thirdly, once he knew what the demon's name was, could he, by use of that name, order the demon out? There are other occasions we find Jesus using that same Jewish method. One example is over in Mark 5, where Jesus was confronted by a demoniac. So he asked him, "What is your name?" The answer was, "My name is Legion, for we are many." But because of that same system, there was one kind of demon that that Judaism could do nothing about. It was the kind of demon that caused the person controlled to be dumb or to be mute so that he could not speak. And because he could not speak, there was no way of establishing communication with this kind of a demon, no way of finding out this demon's name. And so within the framework of Judaism, it was considered impossible to cast this kind of a demon out. However, the rabbis have been teaching well before this day that whenever the Messiah comes, he will even be able to cast out this kind of a demon. About 2 centuries or so before Jesus' day, the Pharisees separate miracles into 2 categories. In one category were those miracles anyone would be able to perform if he was empowered by the Spirit of God to do so. But there was a second category of miracles which were known as messianic miracles, meaning miracles only the Messiah would be able to perform. There were 3 main miracles in the second category, and these were the healing of a Jewish leper, the healing of anyone that was born blind, and the casting out of a dumb demon. So whenever you find Jesus performing one of those 3 miracles in the Gospels, the Jewish response, the Jewish reaction is always radically different than when he performs miracles of this other category. So in verse 22, Jesus casts out a demon that was dumb, and by so doing performed a messianic miracle. This raised among the masses that the question was intended to raise in verse 23. The multitudes raised the issue, "Can this be the son of David? Or isn't he the Jewish Messiah? After all, he's doing those very things we have been taught since childhood only Messiah is supposed to be able to do." Now, while the multitudes are willing to raise the question, "Is he the son of David?" they're not willing to make that decision for themselves. They're looking to the leaders to do it for them. Throughout our history, the Jewish people have tended to labor or to be labor on the complex we call the leadership complex. Whichever way the leaders go, the people are sure to follow. We see this very often throughout the Old Testament, when we see and read many times over, when the king did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, the nation followed, but when the king did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, they also followed. Even today, when we who are ministers and missionaries to Jewish people and share our faith with our Jewish contacts, sooner or later, they'll always raise the same issue, the same objection, and that is, if Jesus really was the Messiah, how come our rabbis have not believed on him? In New Testament times, because of the stranglehold the Pharisaism had upon the Jewish masses, this leadership complex was very strong. So while they are willing to raise the question, "Can this be the son of David?" not willing to make that decision for themselves, they are looking to leaders to make it for them. In light of what's happening, the Pharisees are now stuck with one of 2 options. The first option is to proclaim Jesus to be the Messiah. The second option is to reject his messianic claims. But if they do take that second option and reject his messiahship, they will at the same time have to be able to explain away how come Jesus can do those things they had long been teaching only Messiah is supposed to be able to do. In verse 24, the Pharisees do take that second option and they do reject his messiahship. And then to explain away his special abilities, they claim that he himself is possessed, not by some common demon, but by the prince of demons, Beelzebub. Beelzebub, by the way, is a combination of 2 Hebrew words that mean the Lord of the flies. So this became the Pharisaic basis for the rejection of the messiahship of Jesus. He's not the Messiah on the basis of being demon-possessed. To this, Jesus responded by saying 2 things. First, in verses 25 through 29, he points out that this simply could not be true because it would mean a division in Satan's kingdom. Secondly, in verses 30 through 37, he then pronounces a special judgment upon that generation of Israel for being guilty of a very unique sin, the unpardonable sin, or the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. And because this sin is precisely what he calls it, unpardonable, judgment is now placed against that generation, a judgment that can under no circumstances be removed or alleviated, a judgment that will come 40 years later in AD 70 with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. We should make it very clear in our minds exactly what the unpardonable sin is in the context in which it is always found. It is not an individual sin, but it is a national sin. And it was committed by the Jewish generation of Jesus' day, and it cannot be applied to later Jewish generations. And the content of the unpardonable sin in the context in which it is found is this. It is the national rejection by Israel of the Messiahship of Jesus while he was present on the grounds of being demon-possessed. I'll repeat that. The content of the unpardonable sin is the national rejection by Israel of the Messiahship of Jesus while he was present on the basis of being demon-possessed. Now let me make four ramifications concerning the unpardonable sin. The first ramification is that it is national, not individual. Even individuals of that day and age could and did escape the judgment, as did the Apostle Paul, among others. It's not a sin that anyone could commit today. The one thing the Bible makes very clear is that regardless of what sin anyone commits today, every sin is forgivable to that individual that will come to God through Jesus the Messiah. The nature of the sin is irrelevant. When he died on the cross, he didn't just die for some types of sins, but not for others. He died for every type of sin, rendering every type of sin forgivable to the individual that will come to God through Christ. But for the nation as a nation, it was now unpardonable. The second ramification is that it is a sin that is unique to the generation of Jesus' day. It may not and cannot be applied to later Jewish generations as the Catholic Church has often tried to do. It was to that generation that he came offering himself as the Messiah. It was that generation that officially rejected him. And from now on, we'll see how often two key words will keep coming up. And these two words will be this generation. Because this generation, and only this generation, is guilty of this unique sin. The third ramification is, it is not a sin that any other nation could commit today, because Jesus is not now physically, visibly present with any other nation, offering himself as that nation's Messiah. That was unique to his relationship to Israel, a relationship he has to no other. The fourth ramification is that the commitment of the unpardonable sin by this generation for this generation meant two things. First of all, the kingdom that he has been offering to them since his ministry began is now rescinded. They've lost out on the opportunity to see the kingdom established in their day. It is now rescinded. It is destined to be reoffered to a later Jewish generation that will accept it, which will be the generation of the Great Tribulation, something detailed later in Matthew 24 and 25. The second thing it meant is that this generation was now under a special physical divine judgment, a judgment that would come 40 years later with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Now, having been stung by these words of rebuke, in verse 38, the Pharisees tried to retake the offensive. Then certain scribes and Pharisees answered him, saying, "Teacher, we would see a sign from thee." But he answered and said unto them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign. There shall no sign be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth." At this point, the Pharisees tried to retake the offensive from him by demanding yet another sign, as if Jesus had not done enough to authenticate his messianic claims. Between chapters 4 and 12, he had performed many miracles, including those miracles they themselves had long labeled to be uniquely messianic. In spite of all of the evidence, they have rejected his claims, and so now Jesus announces his new policy concerning his miracles. He says that for the nation there will be no more signs except one, the sign of Jonah, which is the sign of resurrection. Now, Jesus continues to perform many miracles even after this event, but the purpose of his miracles change. No longer is the purpose to serve as signs to Israel, to get Israel to make a decision. That decision has now been made. Instead, the purpose of his miracles from now on are for the training of the 12 disciples, for the new kind of work they'll have to conduct because of this rejection, the kind of work we find them conducting in the book of Acts. But for the nation, no more signs except one, the sign of Jonah, the sign of resurrection, a sign that will come to Israel on three occasions. First will be the resurrection of Lazarus, secondly, the resurrection of Jesus, and thirdly, the resurrection of the two witnesses during the Great Tribulation. Then after announcing his new policy concerning the purpose of his miracles, he once again continues with the theme of judgment and note carefully the emphasis upon that particular generation. Verse 41, the men of Nineveh shall stand up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it. For they repented the preaching of Jonah, behold, the greater Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. Jesus now brings in two Gentile examples from the Old Testament, the men of Nineveh and the queen of Sheba. These were Gentiles who had a lot less light to respond to, but the light that they had to that light, they did respond. And so the great white throne judgment, these Gentiles would be able to stand and condemn this particular Jewish generation for being guilty of the unpardonable sin. The words of judgment come to a conclusion with a story about a demon in verses 43 to 45, though the point of the story is often missed. It concerns a demon that was indwelling a person, but then chose to live, to leave. He was not cast out. He chose to leave on his own free will, looking for a better apartment in which to live. He searches for a while, but when he could find no vacancies, he decides to come back to the person he was possessing indwelling earlier. And when he finds him again, we're told in verse 44, he found him swept, he found him garnished, but at the same time, he still found him empty. Because in the interval period, the man was not indwelled by some other spirit, be it the Holy Spirit or some demonic spirit. It's because he remained empty that this demon is able to re-enter him. But no longer wanting to live all by himself, he invites seven of his buddies to join him, and Jesus says the last state of that man is become worse than the first. Because at the first there's only one demon residing in him, now there are eight demons residing in him because he remained empty. Now the point of the story is made in the last phrase of verse 45. Even so will it be also unto this evil generation. And note again the emphasis upon this generation. Now when this generation began, it began with the preaching of John the Baptist, and the calling of John was to prepare this generation for the acceptance of the Messiahship of Jesus. And by means of the preaching of John, this generation was swept, this generation was garnished. But now with the rejection of his Messiahship, this generation also remains empty. And because it remains empty, he declares the last state will be worse than the first. At the first, they were under Roman domination and had to pay annual tribute to Rome. But Rome allowed them to retain the national entity. Jerusalem was standing, and the temple was functioning in all of its glory and glory. But 40 years after making these statements, legions of Rome invaded the land. And after a 2-year siege, the city was destroyed. The temple was torn down till there was not one stone on top of another. And the Jewish people dispersed all over the world. And so indeed, the last state of this generation did become worse than the first. And to this day, this version is still with us. The fact that Jewish people living in Texas is a picture of that dispersion. If that's not dispersion, I don't know what dispersion could possibly be. Now at this point, the ministry of Jesus changes. It changes radically. It changes in four important areas. The first change you already mentioned, which has to do with the purpose of his miracles. No longer are they for the purpose of serving as signs to Israel. They have now rejected it, but rather it's for the training of the 12 apostles. The second change concerns the people whom he performed these miracles. Until the events of Matthew 12, he performed miracles for the benefit of the masses without requiring them to have faith first. From now on, when he performs miracles only by responding to needs of individuals, and this time he does require they have faith first. Along the same line, until this event, when he did heal someone, he told them, go and proclaim what God has done for you. From now on, whenever he heals a person, he tells them, don't tell anyone what God has done for you. He initiates a policy of silence, and those who benefit from his messianic power are now forbidden to tell anyone about it. The third change concerns the message that he and his disciples will now be presenting. Until Matthew 12, both he and they went all over Israel, city to city, synagogue to synagogue, proclaiming Jesus to be the Messiah. Two chapters earlier, in chapter 10, they were sent out two by two to do that. However, from now on, his own disciples are forbidden to tell anyone that he is the Messiah, and they too must follow the policy of silence. So, for example, later in Matthew 16, when Peter makes his famous confession and says, you are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, Jesus turns to Peter and tells him, don't tell anyone I am the Christ or Messiah. They must follow the policy of silence as well until it is rescinded with the Great Commission of Matthew 28. The fourth change concerns his teaching method. Until the events of Matthew 12, whenever he taught the multitudes, he taught them clearly, distinctly, in terms that they both could and did understand. One fine example is Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, the famous Sermon on the Mount. Matthew points out that when he was done, the people clearly understood what he had to say, and more important, they knew where he differed with the scribes and Pharisees. But now here in the next chapter, chapter 13, whenever he teaches the people in Mass, he always teaches them parabolically. And when the disciples ask Jesus, why have you begun teaching them in parables? He answers that the purpose of the parabolic method of teaching is to hide the truth in the masses, to teach them in broad terms that they cannot and will not understand. By this time, they have received sufficient light to respond correctly. They responded incorrectly and committed the unpardonable sin. And so now, no further light will be given. So anytime he's with the masses and teaches them, always he teaches them in parabolic terms, in terms that they simply do not understand. It is literally impossible to understand why his ministry changes so radically in these four areas. Let's understand how crucial the events of Matthew 12 are. I would say the events of Matthew 12 are by far the most important events in the life of Christ, with the exception of his death and resurrection. The events of Matthew 12 set the stage for the second half of his ministry, sets the stage for the events of the book of Acts. It sets the stage for a new entity to come into being, the church, the body of the Messiah, and it sets the stage for Jewish history for the next 2,000 years, a very crucial turning point in the career of Christ. Yet even after this event, as we look at Matthew 16, verse 1, now and then the Pharisees come back demanding a sign. But notice how Jesus always responds. Matthew 16, verse 1. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came trying him and asked him to show them a sign from heaven. But he answered and said unto them, when it is evening, you say it shall be fair weather, for the heaven is red. In the morning will be foul weather today, for the heaven is red and lowering. You know how to discern the face of the heaven, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign. There shall no sign be given unto it, but the sign of Jonah. And he left them and departed. After Matthew 12, when they come demanding a sign, the answer is always the same. There'll be no more signs but one, the sign of Jonah, the sign of resurrection. Again, a sign that will come to Israel three different times. The resurrections of Lazarus, of Jesus, and the two witnesses in the Great Tribulation. With that background, let's go to the Gospel of John, chapter 11. John 11, In John 11, we are given a lot of verses, 44 verses, in fact, detailing the resurrection of one man, Lazarus. Lazarus was not the first person Jesus raised from the dead. But all the other resurrections are covered from 2 to 4 verses only. They are witnessed to by only a few. And the few witnessed those other resurrections are then told to tell no one about it. In sharp contrast to all the other resurrections, the case of Lazarus, we are given a lot of detail, 44 verses worth of detail. In place of being witnessed to by only a few, the multitudes are present viewing this. And what makes the resurrection of Lazarus more unique than the others? It's unique in that this is the sign Jesus promised to still give them on a national scale. And when this sign is given, they'll have to respond. And if we understand the role that the resurrection of Lazarus plays in the relationship of Jesus as Israel's Messiah, we'll have a better understanding of why things happen the way they do. For example, in verses 1 through 5, a message comes to Jesus from Mary and Martha informing Jesus that their brother Lazarus is ill. And the obvious purpose of the message to get Jesus to come quickly to Bethany so that he could raise Lazarus from his illness before he dies. And you expect to read that as soon as he heard that Lazarus was ill, he immediately departed for Bethany. And from where Jesus was at this point, there was only a one-day trip over to Bethany. But notice how verse 6 reads, "When, therefore..." A good rule of interpreting scripture is, whenever you see this word, therefore, find out what it's there for. It's a logical connective. It's building a case. So he says, when therefore, meaning for the very reason he heard that he was sick, he had at that time 2 days in the place where he was. For the very reason that Lazarus was ill, for that reason, he went nowhere. He stayed put. He's waiting for Lazarus to die, and only after Lazarus is dead does he begin moving towards Bethany. But even then, he moves so slowly that by the time he arrives at Bethany, Lazarus has been dead 4 days. From his Jewish frame of reference, that 4 days of deadness is significant. Because in those days, the rabbis were teaching that when a man dies, his spirit hovers over the body for 3 days. And during those 3 days of hovering, there was always a possibility of a resuscitation. But at the end of the 3rd day, the spirit descends down to Sheol. And from then on, a resuscitation is absolutely impossible, only the miracle of resurrection. And because this is a sign for the multitudes, Jesus made sure they cannot explain this one away by mere resuscitation. Now skip down to verse 42 and notice for whom Lazarus was really being raised. And note it's not merely a favor to Mary and Martha. Verse 42, "And I knew that thou hearest me always, but because of the multitude that stand around, I said it, that they," meaning the multitude, "may believe that thou didst send me." Clearly, this miracle is for the multitude, for the masses. The one miracle he said he would still provide for them. And when this miracle takes place, they must respond. Given. That leads to 2 types of responses. In verse 45, on one hand, many Jewish people respond correctly and believe on him, exercise faith. But in verse 46, the second group, still belaboring a leadership complex, simply report what has just happened to the Pharisees. And because the Pharisees, more than anyone else, know that this is the sign Jesus promised he would still give them, they must respond. And so in verse 47, the Sanhedrin gathers. "The chief priests, therefore, and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, 'What do we? For this man does many signs. If let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation.' But certain one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you take into account it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, that a whole nation perish not.'" Verse 53, "So from that day forth they took counsel, they might put him to death." The Sanhedrin does gather, but in the course of their deliberations, they carry out 1 step further the rejection which has already occurred. In Matthew 12, they rejected his messiahship on the basis of being demon-possessed. In John 11, they go a step further and sentence him to death. and this decree of death begins filtering down to the common people. Verse 57 tells us, now when the chief priests and Pharisees had given commandment that if any man knew where he was, he should show that they might take him. And with this action by the Sanhedrin, the first sign of Jonah is officially rejected. Let's go back to Matthew's gospel again, this time chapter 23. Matthew 23 marks the close of his public ministry. He began in chapter 4. His public ministry actually ends in chapter 23. And it ends with a public denunciation of the leadership of Israel of that day. And that's the entire theme of the passage. He pronounces 7 woes upon the scribes and Pharisees for various sins, but the 7 woes form a circle in that the first woe and the 7th woe deal with the same sin. Verse 13 is the first woe, but woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut the kingdom of heaven against men, for ye enter not in yourselves, neither suffer them that are entering in to enter. In the first woe, the Pharisees are condemned because, first, they are rejecting his messiahship, but secondly, they are leading the nation in rejecting his messiahship as well. What he says in the first woe, he elaborates with the 7th one as of verse 29. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the sepulchres of the prophets and garnish the tombs of the righteous and say, if we had been the days of our fathers, we should not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore ye witness to yourselves that ye are the sons of them that slew the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye offspring of vipers, how shall ye escape the judgment of hell? Therefore, behold, I send unto you prophets, wise men and scribes. Some of them ye shall kill and crucify. Some of them shall ye scourge in the synagogues and persecute from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of Abel the righteous, and the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechiah, whom ye slew between the sanctuary and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon, and note those two words again, this generation. This generation, Jesus says, will not only be held accountable for the rejection of his messiahship, but more so, they'll be held accountable for all of the blood of the Old Testament prophets. Because everything the prophets were going to say about the Messiah had by now been said, and the Old Testament had been finished for well over 4.5 centuries. Furthermore, they had the announcement by John proclaiming the soon coming of the king, and finally the ministry of Jesus, who didn't merely claim to be Messiah, but he authenticated those claims with miracles, signs, and wonders, including those miracles they themselves had long labeled to be uniquely messianic. In spite of all this, they rejected his claims, as now Jesus says they'll be held accountable for the whole body of revealed written truth. Keep in mind that when Jesus used the Old Testament, he used it in the order of the Jewish Bibles, not in the order of the Christian Bibles. What I mean by that is that the number of books between the Jewish Old Testament and the Christian one is the same, but the order is not the same. The first book, of course, is the same, Genesis, but the last book of the Jewish order is not Malachi as you're used to, but 2 Chronicles is the last book of the Jewish order. In verse 35, Jesus names 2 men, Abel found in Genesis, the first book, and then Zechariah found in 2 Chronicles, which is in the last book of the Jewish order. And by naming these 2 men, what he's saying is, you'll be held accountable for everything from Genesis to 2 Chronicles, a figure of speech being the whole body of revealed written truth, much as we use a similar figure today when we say from Genesis to Revelation, we mean the whole body of revealed written truth. This generation, guilty of the unpardonable sin, will not be held accountable for the whole body of revealed truth. A few days after these words were spoken came the second sign of Jonah, the resurrection of Jesus. But the second sign of Jonah is rejected in the first 7 chapters of the book of Acts. The stoning of Stephen by the Sanhedrin, Acts 7, marks the final official rejection of that second sign of Jonah. That's why only as of chapter 8 in Acts does the gospel for the first time go out to the non-Jewish world. For the first 7 chapters, the gospel stayed within the Jewish world alone. The point I've made so far is this. It was leadership of Israel that led the nation to the rejection of the Messiahship of Jesus. In light of that, then, what is the basis of the second coming, or what must take place before he can return for the purpose of setting up his kingdom? Out of many passages that deal with that issue, we will, for the sake of time, look at only five, beginning with Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26. In Leviticus 26, Moses outlines what was to become Jewish history. When he wrote it, it was all prophecy. Much of this has now been fulfilled in the course of Jewish history. He points out that when the Jews enter the land of Israel, in the course of time, they will fall into periods of disobedience that will in turn bring on different types of divine discipline. First will come subjugation, fulfilled in the days of the judges. Secondly, captivity, fulfilled in the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. But thirdly, will come a worldwide scattering, which came in the New Testament the context as a direct result of the rejection of the Messiahship of Israel, of Jesus. So by the end of verse 39, the dispersion is a fact, and the first 9 verses have already been fulfilled through Jewish history. But Moses continued to write. In verse 40, "And they shall confess their iniquity, and the iniquity of their fathers, in the trespass which they trespassed against me. And also that because they walked contrary unto me, also walked contrary unto them, and brought them into land of their enemies. If then their uncircumcised heart be humbled, and they then accept of the punishment of their iniquity, then will I remember my covenant with Jacob, and also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land." In verse 42, Moses writes that God has every intent of fulfilling to Israel all of the promises and blessings contained within the Abrahamic covenant, especially as it pertains to the borders of the promised land. "I will remember the land." However, the enjoyment of all of the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant, especially the land, is preconditioned by verse 40. "They shall confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers." First of all, note that the word iniquity is singular, with a, secondly, with a different article, the iniquity, meaning there is one specific sin he has in mind, a specific sin which was committed by their fathers and then continued by them that must be confessed before they can enjoy all of the benefits of the Abrahamic covenant. Our second passage is Jeremiah 3. Verse 12 of Jeremiah chapter 3. Verse 12, Jeremiah chapter 3. "Go and proclaim these words toward the north and say, Return, thou backsliding Israel, say Jehovah. I will not look in anger upon you, for I am merciful, say Jehovah, will not look in anger forever. Only confess thine iniquity, that thou hast transgressed against Jehovah thy God, and hast scattered thy waste as rains on every green tree. Ye have not obeyed my voice, saith Jehovah." Now verses 14 through 18 go on to list the various blessings the Jewish people enjoy in the messianic or millennial kingdom. In verse 14 he says the Jews will be regathered one by one until we are back in the land of Zion. In verse 15, "In that day God will give to Israel shepherds, righteous ones, that will feed the people with knowledge and understanding, never again be guilty of leading the people astray." In verse 16, "In that day they won't even so much as think of rebuilding the Ark of the Covenant, because in verse 17, God himself in a visible way in the person of the Messiah will rule from the city of Jerusalem." And finally, in verse 18, the Jews will be so reunited so that they'll never again be split into two Jewish kingdoms again. But the enjoyment of all of these conditions of verses 14 through 18, conditions of the Messianic kingdom, are preconditioned by verse 13, "Only confess thine iniquity." And once again, there were iniquities both singular and definite. There must be one specific sin that has to be confessed before they can enjoy these blessings of the millennial age. Our third passage is Zechariah 12. The last three chapters of Zechariah, one unit, one prophetic discourse God revealed to Zechariah. Chapter 13 speaks of the national cleansing of Israel's sins, while chapter 14 speaks of two more things, the second coming in verses 1 through 15 and the messianic kingdom in verses 16 through 21. However, the second coming and kingdom of chapter 14 and the Israel's national cleansing in chapter 13 are all preconditioned by chapter 12, verse 10. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. They shall look unto me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son, and they shall be in bitterness for him as one who is in bitterness for his firstborn. Before there can be the national cleansing of Israel's sins, as in chapter 13, or the second coming of kingdom, as in chapter 14, what must happen first is chapter 12, verse 10. They need to look unto the one whom they have pierced. A day must come when they begin mourning for him, as one mourns for only son. Until chapter 12, verse 10 is fulfilled, chapters 13 and 14 cannot be fulfilled. Our fourth passage is Hosea, chapter 5. That's the first minor prophet, Hosea 5. Throughout the fifth chapter of Hosea, it is God who is doing the speaking. God is still speaking as we come to verse 15, where God says, I will go and return to my place until they confess their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me earnestly. Before anyone can return to a place, he must first leave it. Only after leaving it could he then return to it. God is the speaker here, and God says he's returning to his place. God's place is heaven, so before God can return to heaven, he must first leave it. And when did God leave heaven? He left heaven at the incarnation, when God became man, the person of Jesus of Nazareth. He returned to heaven at the ascension of the Mount of Olives. The verse goes on to say he will not come back to this earth until that singular offense is confessed, adding the warning, in their affliction they will seek him earnestly. Now, what is the Jewish national offense committed against Jesus? It was not in killing him. In actuality, it was the Gentiles who killed Jesus, and Gentiles put Jesus to death. The Jewish national offense lies in rejecting his messiahship on the basis of demon possession. Until that specific sin is confessed, there will be no return. Now, don't lose your place in Hosea. We'll have to come right back to it. Keep your finger there and turn to Matthew 23, our fifth account. Matthew 23, we're in this chapter a few moments ago and pointed out that as a theme, it contains Messiah's denunciation of the leadership of Israel for leading the nation in rejecting his messiahship. He is still addressing Israel's leaders as we come to verse 37 of Matthew 23. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the killer of the prophets and stoned them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as the hen gathers her chickens under her wings, but ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. In verse 37, Jesus summarizes his 3.5-year ministry to Israel, how often he longed to spread his hands out and give the holy city the messianic protection predicted by the prophets of old. But it says, ye would not, more literally, ye willed it not when they rejected his claims. In verse 38, he says, for that reason your house is left unto you desolate. The temple is destined to be destroyed. But then note verse 39. He says to them, they will not see him again till it's they who say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. From his Jewish frame of reference, that is an official messianic greeting. The rabbis taught that whenever the Messiah comes, he must be welcomed with these words, for they come from a messianic psalm, Psalm 118 and verse 26. That same psalm also says, the stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner. His point is this, that just as Jewish leaders once led the nation in rejecting him, a day must come when the Jewish leaders will lead the nation in accepting him. The basis of the second coming, as we can deduct from these five passages among others we don't have time to look at, is twofold. First, they must confess the national sin of rejecting his messiahship on the basis of demon possession. Secondly, they must plead for him to return, to mourn for him as one mourns for only son. Until those two things happen, there'll be no second coming. And while the rapture has no preconditions, it can happen any moment, the second coming does have this key precondition. Israel's national salvation must precede the second coming. Let's go back to Hosea. Now in our first session this morning on the Jews in the Tribulation, when we dealt with Revelation 12, I pointed out that once Satan is confined to the earth, he expends all of his energies to try to wipe out the Jews, and I raised the question of logic. Why pick on the Jews just because your time is short? If we understand the theological foundations of anti-Semitism, understand why that satanic war has always been around. Satan, of course, knows that once Christ comes back, his career is over with. But he also knows Jesus will not come back till the Jewish people ask him to come back. If Satan can ever succeed in wiping out all the Jews before they have a chance to plead for him to return, then he will not return, and Satan's career is eternally safe. That's why there has been this unending war against the Jews since the days of Abraham. That's why things like the pogroms occurred and the Crusades occurred. That's why the Holocaust occurred. And that's why once we are in the tribulation and Satan knows his time is short, he will then expend all his energies to try to wipe out the Jews once and for all. Now here in Hosea we have a place where chapter got divided where it should not have been. Chapter 6 should have begun by verse 4, new context begins. The first three verses of chapter 6 really belong with the fifth chapter. Hosea 5:15 ended with a statement that he won't come back till they ask him to come back, till they confess the offense. The first three verses of chapter 6 is the meeting of the demand of 5:15. The words are the words of a call or decree, such as those issued by leaders. Come, let's return unto Jehovah. He hath torn, he will heal us. He hath smitten, and he will bind us up. After 2 days will he revive us. On the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live before him. Let us know, let us follow on to know the Lord. His going forth is sure as the morning, and he will come unto us as the rain, as latter rain that waters the earth. In the closing days of tribulation, in conjunction with Armageddon, the affliction of 5:15, the details of which we'll study at the 4 o'clock session, the Jewish leaders will finally discover why these things have fallen upon them, and they'll realize the root cause has been the rejection of his messiahship. Once they realize that, they will then issue this decree to the whole nation to come to faith. And once this edict is issued, that will begin the last 3 days of the tribulation, the last 3 days before the second coming. During the first 2 days of these last 3 days, they'll confess the national sin, the words of which, by the way, are found in Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. Then on the third of the last 3 days, they'll confess and they will then plead for the Messiah to return, the words of which are found in places like Isaiah 64, Psalm 79, and Psalm 80. And on the third day, the whole nation will be saved as a nation. In the words of Isaiah 66, they'll be born in one day. In the words of Paul in Romans 11, all Israel will be saved. And by fulfilling the condition of second coming, that will bring about that second coming. Exactly what happens then and the circumstance that brings this about, we'll be studying in the 4 o'clock hour. But I hope you begin to see the practicality of understanding the precondition to his return in the role where Jewish evangelism plays today. Most American churches divide the missions program into two categories, which are invariably home missions and foreign missions. The Bible also divides missions into two categories, but those are not the biblical categories. But in Acts 15, Galatians 2, Romans 11, the two types of missions are Jewish missions and Gentile missions. The purpose of Gentile missions is spelled out in Acts 15, to take out from among the Gentiles a people for his name. But Jewish mission is part of an overall prophetic program aimed towards, ultimately, the return of the Lord. Now, the purpose of any Jewish mission, such as Ariel Ministries, with whom I serve, is to win Jewish people now, so that, by means of rapture, they can escape the terrible days of the tribulation. As I shared in my testimony, I'm glad to say, in our almost 12 years of existence, we've never had a dry quarter, never been a three-month period that we didn't see at least one Jewish person come to saving faith. I'm happy to say most of the time it's been more than that. But although we are seeing many Jews coming to faith through our branches and other Jewish ministries in the country and elsewhere, we recognize the teachings of Romans 11 that a blindness in part had befallen Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so in this day and age, it's going to be the remnant that will come to saving faith. So we have a second goal, and the second goal is to give the Jewish people knowledge of what the gospel actually is. Jews hear many things about Jesus. Much of it is warped and wrong, as I try to share my own testimony, and few Jews can really tell you what the gospel actually is. So our second purpose is to give them a knowledge of what the gospel actually is, so at least they understand what the issues are. They might reject the message for now. But I believe that many of those who heard the message prior to the rapture will believe it afterwards, and number among the 144,000 Jews. The 144,000 Jews can then reach out leadership of Israel. The leaders in turn can then lead the nation to accept the Messiah, and that in turn will bring about the second coming. So Jewish missions has both a short-term and long-term goal. Short-term, winning the Jewish people through Messiah today. Long-term goal, to bring about the return of the Lord by giving the gospel out in mass to the Jewish people.